This is Audible.
Audible Originals presents Screwball, written by Simon Rich, performed by Beck Bennett and Scott Aiello.
The best thing about playing baseball is the chow. They give you $3 a day for meal money, and you get to pick the things you eat. For breakfast, I had flapjacks with butter, biscuits with gravy, beefsteak with eggs, 6 rolls with butter, 2 sides of bacon, 2 sides of liverwurst, oatmeal, ketchup, and a side of butter. I never go hungry like before. It feels funny being so far from the orphanage. Good news is, I'm not the only rookie. There's another boy named Jack, and they have us rooming together. Even though he's my age, I really look up to him. He wakes up every day at 4 a.m. and does 2 hours of German squats. Then he drinks raw eggs and runs up and down the staircase till he pukes. He's what they call a teetotaler. No drinking, smoking, chew, or even sweets. He does have a girl named Bella that he writes to at Miss Parker's finishing school in Buffalo, but he says their relationship is noble and above suspicion. I haven't seen him play yet, but if anyone's going to make the team, it's him. I was in knots our first practice. I've only ever played orphan ball, and there's guys here who played up in the majors like Deke Derrick from Philly and Speedy Ball from the Cleveland Naps. I wanted to ask them all sorts of questions like, did they ever meet Cy Young? But Jack warned me not to speak to any vets. You have to earn their respect first. You'll know you've been accepted, he told me, when they give you a nickname. I asked him if he had a nickname yet, and he said, not really. And I said, what does that mean? And he said that some of the fellas called him Junior. And I asked him why, and his voice got kind of quiet, and he said it was because his daddy was the manager. And I said really loud, why didn't you tell me your daddy was the manager? Deke and Speedy looked over at us, and I asked them if they knew that Jack's daddy was the manager, and Deke nodded slowly and said, yes, we're all aware. All in all, it was a pretty good first day in the pros, although one embarrassing thing did happen at the end. Junior's daddy, our manager, Mr. Dunn, lined up all us pitchers for batting practice, and we were supposed to bunt, but when I got up to the plate, I saw all those vets staring at me, and I got so nervous I forgot to lay one down, and I just swung the bat like regular, and the ball went over the fence and the rail tracks and ended up splashing in the river. And then everyone got really quiet, like the nuns at the orphanage when I used to screw up doing my sums. And Mr. Dunn stared at me and said, my God. So I said I was sorry and that I'd remember to bunt next time, and I started to run to get the ball because, you know, that's Orioles property. But before I got past the infield, Deke whistled for me to come back, and he patted me on the shoulder and said, don't worry about the ball. We got plenty of them, babe. And I turned to Junior and gave him a thumbs up, because now I had a nickname too, just like him. And since then, that's what everyone's been calling me. Babe, or the Babe, or Babe Ruth.
Presenting Screwball, the incredible true story of the 1914 minor league Baltimore Orioles. Starring pitcher Babe Ruth, career batting average .342, world champions .7. Manager Jack Dunn Sr., career coaching wins 2,107. And at backup right field, Jack Dunn Jr., career minor league average .175. Part 1, Spring Training.
That night, I saw Junior writing numbers in a book. I asked him about it, and he said he likes to track his daily progress using mathematics. And he flipped through the pages, and it had all his records from his high school, and he showed me how he'd worked to make sure his batting average went up every year. So by the time he was a senior, he was hitting almost .250. And he asked me what I'd batted for St. Mary's Home for Boys, and I explained that things weren't really like that at the orphanage. I mostly just played casual-like, and then one day I was splitting lumber in the workyard, and Brother Matthias came by with Mr. Dunn and said, George, throw the ball for this nice man. And he handed me a baseball, and I threw it over a building, and then I found out I was going to get to ride a train. We were about to go to sleep when a clump of dirt smacked against the window. So I jumped out of bed and looked outside, and all the veterans were there, and they said they were going to a tavern. And I said I wasn't sure if Junior went for taverns, but that I would ask him, and they said, don't ask Junior. We don't want him to come. Don't invite him. Just come without him. Please. Don't bring him. And I turned to Junior, who was sitting right beside me, and I told him how swell I thought it was that the veteran supported him so much in his decision to be a teetotaler. And he sighed and said, thanks, babe. I was nervous to go out with the veterans, but it turns out Junior was wrong about them. They are the most welcoming group I've ever seen. They kept slapping me on the back and offering me whiskeys. I wanted a drink to stop my heart from pounding, but I figured I'd lay off the stuff to follow Junior's example. So I drank Coca-Cola and listened while the guys told me stories about their playing days, and I asked if they had ever met Cy Young. And they said they hadn't, but Mr. Dunn sure had. And when I asked what they meant, they explained that Mr. Dunn once shut him out 2-0. I had no idea Mr. Dunn had been a ball player, but it turns out he pitched a few years in the majors, and he would have been an all-time great, but one day his elbow popped out of his arm. He tried to keep pitching, but he couldn't throw curveballs anymore. They just didn't have the same bite. And also, batters could tell when he was about to do one because he would scream really loud. You know, from the agony. When he started in the majors, his nickname was Peppy Dunn because he was always pacing around the dugout, clapping his hands with a big smile on his face. But after his injury, people started calling him Screaming Dunn, and then Pain Dunn, or Sad Dunn. And now he didn't have a nickname anymore. He was just Mr. Dunn, the manager of the Baltimore Orioles. I asked the guys why Mr. Dunn didn't try to manage in the majors, and they said no front office would give him a shot on account of his record in the minors. The Orioles have been losing for years in AA, and last year they finished almost 20 games out, even behind the Rochester Hustlers, which is really saying something because their team is like a carnival team, and they've got a midget second baseman who does whole routines right in the middle of the game with a cane and everything, and he's pretty talented, everyone agrees, but still, you don't want to lose to a guy like that at baseball. Mr. Dunn's only chance of getting noticed by the majors would be if we won the whole league, by a lot. Maybe we will, I said. We got some good guys, right? It doesn't matter, Deke said. You're only as good as your weakest link. And I got nervous and said, are you guys talking about me? And for some reason, everybody laughed. Junior was still up when I got home writing letters to Bella at Miss Parker's finishing school in Buffalo, and I realized, with cuts coming soon, that it might be our last night together. So I said to him that I sure hoped I made the team, but if I didn't, I'd write to him from the orphanage, care of the Baltimore Orioles, and he could send me letters from the road with all his box scores so I could follow along when he was making good. And at least, when I was old and gray, I'd be able to tell everyone I'd met a baseball legend, the great Jack Dunn Jr. The next day was the last day of tryouts, and Mr. Dunn made an announcement. He said he'd heard a rumor that some players were concerned that he was biased, but it wasn't true. The Baltimore Orioles are a meritocracy, he said. Everyone gets the same shot. It doesn't matter if you're a veteran, a rookie, or, you know, whatever. A few guys turned towards Junior and he looked down at his cleats. In order to guarantee fairness, Mr. Dunn went on, I have developed a series of drills that are mathematically designed to test each player's aptitude. Then he blew his whistle and it was time to get to work. I tried my best at his drills, but I'd never done them before and it was hard to keep everything straight. For example, one time we were doing throws from deep center and I was supposed to toss it to the cutoff man at second, but I forgot and just threw it past him on a line drive straight into the catcher's mitt and the catcher fell backwards. And someone stood and said, our game is forever changed, nothing will ever be the same. And everyone kind of bowed their heads silently for a while like the nuns did in the orphanage when the priest talked about Jesus. And I was like, what's happening? Another mistake I made is I hit a ball too hard and it exploded. The toughest drill was grounders. Mr. Dunn's getting on, but he can still hit with pop, and he was laying down all kinds of junk at us. The rollers were fine, but the one-hoppers gave everyone fits. Even Deke and Speedy missed a couple. I handled mine all right, but there was one that hit a pebble and bounced real high over my left shoulder, so I couldn't reach it with my glove, and I had no choice but to jump up, grab it with my bare hand, and throw it around my body in a single twirling motion. Next up was Junior's turn. I could tell he was nervous, but he handled the rollers like a pro. It was pretty impressive to watch. It was almost like he could tell in advance which side his dad was going to hit to. I wondered if they'd ever done the drill before. When they were finished, Mr. Dunn said, perfect score, unbelievable. Junior smiled with relief and was about to leave the infield when Deke said, what about the one-hoppers? Mr. Dunn's eyes got real round like a frightened rabbit's. But then he smiled wide and said very proper-like, thank you so much for reminding me, Deke. I almost forgot about the one-hoppers. Then he turned to Junior in front of everyone and said a little softly, you ready, kiddo? And Junior cleared his throat and said, yes, sir. And Mr. Dunn took out a bucket of balls. These are one-hoppers now, he said. Yes, sir, Junior said again. And he pounded his mitt to show that he was ready. And Mr. Dunn hit over a one-hopper and it bounced right by his son. Deke and Speedy both started to laugh, and Junior's face turned red, but Mr. Dunn didn't seem to notice any of that. He just smiled at Junior and said, it's all right, here comes another. and he hit over the next ball, but that one got through too. And Mr. Dunn smiled even wider and said, "Great effort!" And he kept shouting out things like that after every miss, like, "Good hustle," or "Way to stay with it," or "Nice technique." But by the middle of the bucket, he'd run out of things to say, so he just started saying, "Nice try," over and over. "Nice try! Nice 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 try!" After about the 10th miss, Junior started staring at his glove and poking at the leather and shaking his head and squinting like there was something the matter with his glove. So I guess maybe there was something the matter with his glove. In the end, there was just one ball left in the bucket. Mr. Dunn hit it over and it bounced off a pebble and started to sail over Junior's shoulder. And I thought it would get by him, but then he jumped up and tried to barehand it like how I'd done before. And he was really close, but at the last second, instead of snagging the ball, he fell down hard on his face and his pants and jock split open and his butt popped out. And everyone kind of gasped because there was his butt. And he just kind of lay there on the dirt for a while with his face in the mud and everybody staring at his naked butt. There was a long pause, and then Mr. Dunn blew his whistle and said tryouts were over. Deke said Mr. Dunn always nailed the roster to the tree behind the backstop so everyone would know where to find it. It could be 10 minutes or it could be 10 hours, depending on how long it took Mr. Dunn to make his picks. I decided to stand by the tree and wait there as long as it took. After a few minutes, though, I started to get hungry, and I thought, they're sending me back to the home tomorrow morning. I better spend all my meal money now in case they try to take it from me. So I went to the hotel restaurant and gave the maitre d' all the coins I had and told them to bring me as much food as that could buy me. And it didn't have to make any sense. It could be all mixed together in a bucket or whatever. And I didn't care if I got the shits. And I thought about Junior and how he loved to drink eggs in the morning for his puking exercise and how he'd need to keep his strength up once the season started. So I bought him some eggs as a present. And I stuck them in my pockets, and it was around that time I heard a hammering noise. The lineup was nailed to the tree behind the backstop, right where Deke had said it would be. And I was so nervous, I felt like drinking a whole gallon of whiskey. But then I thought to myself, well, if I don't make the team, at least I got to ride on a train and see a big city like Fayetteville and go on an elevator and try tapioca, so I should be thankful. Then I said a prayer to God and read the list, and there I was. George Herman Ruth, pitcher, outfield. And I kept reading my name over and over again to make sure I wasn't reading it wrong, but I wasn't. That was really my name, written all fancy and tight, just like a newspaper. And I was so relieved I felt like crying, and all I could think was, I can't wait to show Junior. So I ripped the roster off the post and ran up to our room. He was oiling his glove in the dark, and when I told him the news, he nodded solemnly and said, "Congratulations, babe. You deserve it." And I said, "Thanks." And then there was a pause, and he said, "What about me? Did I make the team?" And I said, "Of course." And then he pumped his fist. And I said, "I mean, I haven't checked the roster yet, but I figure." And he cursed under his breath and said, "Would you please check the roster?" So I said, "All right," and smoothed out the roster and scanned through all the names. And I couldn't find him anywhere. But then, at the bottom, I saw his name scrawled down in pencil. "Yep, here you are," I said. "Jack Dunn Jr." "Oh, thank God," he said. "I take it I didn't get shortstop?" "Speedy's playing short," I said. "Figures. Am I in left?" "No." "Center?" "No." "Right?" "No." "Then what am I?" "It says here you're the Ice Boy." And I pointed out his name at the bottom of the list. "Jack Dunn Jr., Ice Boy." And I wanted to ask him what an ice boy was, but I was too embarrassed, since I figured it was some professional term that I should know, especially now that I was a real baseball man. Whatever it meant, I could tell Junior was excited because he kept shaking his head and saying, "Oh my God." And then I smiled at him and said, "I know, we're living our dreams." And I gave him a big bear hug and there were all these loud crunches. And when I saw his gooey shirt, I broke out laughing because I'd forgotten about all his eggs.
Part 2, regular season. Play ball.
It turns out Ice Boy means pretty much what it sounds like, just a boy who carries around ice for the team. It isn't a very baseball-heavy job, but in practice, Mr. Dunn said that's the point. It's important for Junior to stay fresh so we can have some talent on reserve as an insurance policy. So far, no one's needed a pinch hitter, although I think Deke might be getting sore because at least four times a game he calls out, "Ice boy," and snaps his fingers until Junior brings him a slab. I'm really glad that Junior made the roster because I'd be lost without him. The guy's a baseball expert, and I'm always asking his advice on stuff I need to know, like how do you autograph a baseball, or talk to reporters, or pose for a painting, or go get a key from a mayor at a parade. This morning they wrote about me in the paper, and I had no idea what it meant. So I said, "Hey, Junior, what does it mean when they write that my rags-to-riches story is in some way the story of America itself? Is it good or is it bad?" And he didn't respond because he doesn't like to talk to me when I'm in the shitter. So I finished up and came out and asked him again if the article was good or bad. And he said, "It's good, babe." And I said, "Phew." And he looked at me in the eye and said, "It must be an incredible feeling to know that you have worth." And I said, "Yeah." We started the season 5-0, and all the credit goes to Mr. Dunn. He's always coming up with good strategies. Like when I was pitching against the Newark Indians, he told me to strike everyone out. And that ended up working really well for us. He's kind of like a baseball genius. We kept on winning that whole month against the Jersey City Skeeters and the Providence Grays, and I got to where other teams were running scared. In Rochester, the Hustlers were so nervous that the midget didn't even do his cane routine. He just wore a glove and played regular. We beat him 12-2, and when we got back to the hotel, there was a telegram from Mr. Dunn from one of his old friends in the majors congratulating him on the streak. He didn't say anything, but he got this huge grin on his face, and he started to pace around the lobby, clapping his hands, and Deke said, "Hey, look, it's Pepe Dunn." The next morning, he called a meeting and said we gotta focus. No booze and no late nights. Because we're tied for first with the Buffalo Bisons, and we were going to play them real soon. Junior doesn't smile much during these meetings. He mainly just stares down at his ice. But when Mr. Dunn said Buffalo, he looked up and grinned in a way I hadn't seen in weeks. And as soon as we got back to our room, he made a telephone call to Bella at Miss Parker's finishing school and told her he was going to be in Buffalo. And he told her how excited he was and asked if she had gotten all his letters and his love poems and if she remembered their night together at the mixer, how they danced the turkey trot with the moon up overhead, and did she think about him often the way he thought about her. And then she said something back, and Junior's smile kind of faded, and he held out the receiver and said in a whisper, "She wants to talk to you, babe." So I talked to the girl, and it turned out that she had seen my picture in the paper. And we talked for a spell about baseball and what I liked better, throwing strikeouts or hitting home runs. And she asked me about my body and how I got my muscles the way they were and if I was that strong in real life or only in the pictures. And long story short, Belle said she would visit our hotel when we got to Buffalo. So I hung up and told Junior the good news, how he was going to see his girl. And he clenched his jaw and said, "She's not my girl." And I was pretty surprised because I thought he liked her a whole lot. But he said no, he never really did. They just danced once at a mixer, and it was only a turkey trot, and he'd just been writing her love poetry to be polite, because really he thought she was nothing special, and he didn't have any feelings for her at all. So I said, "Well, in that case, is it okay if I take her out? Because she seems nice." And he closed his eyes and whispered, "I don't care what you do. I don't care about anything anymore." So I smiled and said, "Great." I was excited to go meet this Bella, but as we rode to Buffalo, I started to get nervous, because the truth is, I've never been out with a lady, especially not a fancy one who'd finished at a school. I started to worry about things like, what kind of place should I take her to, and what if I run out of meal money, and what if I say the wrong thing or laugh at the wrong time, and what if she doesn't like me? And by the time we pulled into the station, I was so scared, I almost ordered a whiskey. But things turned out to be a lot easier than I thought. Bella was waiting in the lobby of the hotel, so that made things simple, and when she saw me, she said I didn't have to take her out, and instead we should get straight to screwing, because her curfew was at 9 and she wanted to go hard. So I turned to Junior, who was standing near us, and I asked him if he minded sleeping on the couch, and he said it was fine, because life has no meaning. So I said, "Great." So then me and Bella went up to the room and went at it, and I don't know what they teach at finishing school, but she definitely knew more than I did about a lot of things. And it was fun, but after a couple hours, I said, "I can't take this anymore." Because even though I'm a professional athlete, I was starting to get really sore. And she said, "Don't stop, babe." And I said, "I gotta. I'm really hurt down there." And she said, "Well, maybe you can ice it, like a muscle." And I said, "Where am I going to get ice?" But then as I said that, I realized, hey, This is a pretty lucky coincidence because I happen to be roommates with the best damn ice boy in the minor leagues. So I put on a towel from Odyssey and opened the door, and there was Junior on the couch reading the Bible with earmuffs on and the radio going full blast, and I asked him to please carve me some ice. And I explained why I needed it, how I was sore from all the screwing with Bella. And he said, "All right." And he reached under his bed and pulled out his ice chest and carved me out a piece. Then he carved out a second piece and put it in a glass and filled it up from a large bottle of whiskey. And I said, "Aren't you a teetotaler?" And he said, "I am nothing." And he drank the entire glass in one swallow. And that's when I clocked that maybe there was something going on with Junior. Like, maybe there was something causing him some kind of trouble. He had his glove out and he was staring at it, just turning it over in his hands like he was looking for something. And he asked me, "How do you do it? Is there a secret?" And I said, "Yes. You got to put your mind on something else. When she's going, you just picture yourself like on a trolley, and that way you can last." And he closed his eyes and said, "I meant baseball." And I said, "Oh, well, yeah, I've got one trick to playing, but I don't like to tell it." And he grabbed me by my shirt with both of his hands, and he pulled my face so close I could smell the whiskey on his breath. And I was surprised at his strength, because he's just a little guy, and he shouted at me, "Please, you gotta tell me, please." And when I looked into his eyes, I could see by the tears that he was desperate. So I said, "Okay, but if I tell you, you gotta swear that you don't tell anybody." And he promised me he wouldn't tell a soul. So I checked the hallway to make sure no one was listening. And then I closed the blinds too, just to be safe, and told him my big secret to baseball. Whenever I'm pitching or hitting, I always make sure to put a little mustard on it. And then I leaned back and smiled like, "You're welcome." And he took a long, slow breath and said, "That does not help me." And I said, "Why not? Just do it like I said. Put mustard." And he stood up and shouted, "I don't have any mustard, you idiot. Not everyone has mustard. Some of us are born without mustard." And I didn't understand why he was so angry, because up until this moment, everything between us had been so perfect. So I said, "Please don't be mad at me, Junior. You're my best friend." And he said, "We weren't friends. We were enemies." Then he climbed into bed and pulled the covers over his head and turned off the lights. And it felt like my first night at the orphanage. I didn't know any of the other boys, and when I cried, they screamed at me to shut it because they didn't like me yet, since it was before they had seen me play baseball. I try not to think about that time, but sitting there with Junior, it came back in a rush, and I felt so lonesome my heart began to pound, like the engine of a train, faster and faster. Thump a thump a thump a thump. And I got so bad I did something I knew I shouldn't do. I went and reached for the whiskey. When I woke up, I knew something was wrong, because instead of being in the hotel, I was underneath a bridge. There was a nice bum there, and he explained that I had shown up with the bottle empty, naked, and said, "I have no friends, and this is where I live now." So I asked the bum how to get back to the baseball team, but he didn't know what I meant, so I thought, well, I'll find Junior. He'll know what to do. But then I remembered he didn't like me anymore. And for the first time in a while, I was on my own. So I ran back to the hotel, and the bellhop said, "Babe, you need to put on clothes, and also, the team left without you." So I ran to the train station and jumped on the train while it was moving, and it was a really fast car, but after a few hours, I noticed that the conductor was talking funny, saying things like, "Bonjour this," and "Bonjour that." And after about a day, I realized that maybe this train didn't go to Baltimore. So I got off the train and ran up to a woman and said, "Help me, I'm Babe Ruth, the baseball player." And she was like, "Bonjour this," and "Bonjour that." And I thought, you know, this isn't great. And the snow was coming down, so I ran into a barn, and I figured, well, I guess I'm going to die. But then a farmer came and told me, "This is Canada." And he gave me overalls and put me on a train, and after a couple days, I got back to a place where people knew baseball, and some kids recognized me from the paper, and they took me to Orioles Park. There was almost no one in the stands, and the people that were there looked sour. I could see from the scoreboard that we dropped to third place, and we'd lost the last six straight, and we were about to lose another since we were down 10-0 in the bottom of the ninth with two outs and nobody on base. Mr. Dunn was sitting in the dugout with his head in his hands, not looking peppy at all. And I felt pretty rotten until I saw a sight that cheered me up. Junior was coming up to bat, and even though he'd said that we were enemies, I couldn't help but root for him. He took a few practice swings, and I noticed his hitting form had changed. He'd turned himself into a slugger, swinging from his knees with so much force it made him spin around. He whiffed on the first pitch, and the second one too. But then, on the third pitch, he made some kind of an adjustment, and instead of whiffing, he fell face first into the mud, and his pants and jock split open, and his butt popped out. And everyone kind of gasped because there was his butt. And the whole stadium got quiet, and I felt real bad for him, so I shouted, "Nice try!" And when Mr. Dunn heard my voice, he turned his back on his son and ran in my direction. I figured Mr. Dunn would be sore at me for missing so many games, but he wasn't as angry as I expected. Instead of yelling, he threw his arms around my neck and kissed my face over and over, kind of like I was a baby. And he asked me if I could pitch tomorrow, and I said, sure. And he pumped his fist and started dancing, just shaking his hips back and forth and singing, ha-cha-cha, ha-cha-cha, and kind of spinning around in a circle and making little guns with his fingers. And then he called out for Junior. And Junior ran over and told his daddy how his strikeout had been an aberration and that he had learned enormously from the experience. Mr. Dunn said he appreciated that, but going forward, he would need Junior to take more responsibility on the team. And Junior grinned and said absolutely, and he'd already scouted the next three pitching staffs, and he couldn't wait to take them on. And there was a long pause. And Mr. Dunn explained that Junior misunderstood, and that what he meant by more responsibility is that he wanted Junior to stop playing baseball and instead watch me 24/7 and follow me around and take care of me, sort of like my nursemaid. And Junior said, "Sir, with all due respect, I disagree with this baseball decision." And Mr. Dunn tried to cut him off, but Junior kept talking about how he was making progress, and the more Mr. Dunn tried to interrupt him, the wilder Junior got. And he took out his notebook and flipped through all the pages with all of his statistics and some graphs and charts he'd made about his rate of improvement. And Mr. Dunn said it all looked swell and that he was very proud of him, but that he needed Junior's help to win the league. And Junior said, "If you want me to help you, you can put me in the lineup." And Mr. Dunn got kind of flustered and said, "That's not where you belong." And I thought Junior would get angry, but instead he gave a weird smile and said, "Yeah, all right, I'll watch the babe." And I threw up my hands and cheered, you know, because I was happy me and Junior were best friends again. I wanted to go back to the room to rest, but Junior said we should celebrate our new arrangement. So I followed him down the street to downtown Baltimore, and I asked him where we were going, and he said it was a special surprise. And he led me through a door, and it was full of people, and they saw me, and they all shouted, "Babe!" And Junior explained that it was a special bar for Orioles fanatics. And while he was talking, someone came up to Junior and said, "Hey, nice replica Orioles uniform." And I said, "That's not a replica. Junior's on the team." And everybody laughed really hard. And then Junior said, "Hey, who wants to buy the great Babe Ruth a drink?" And pretty quick, the bartender came over with a whiskey and said it was on the house. And I said to Junior, "Are you sure this is a good idea? Because the last time I drank whiskey, I ended up naked in a foreign barn." And he said, "Babe, don't you trust me?" And I said, "Of course I trust you. Why wouldn't I?" And so I drank the whiskey, then another and another. And then I went to use the shitter, but when I got out, I couldn't find Junior anywhere. And whenever someone tapped me on the shoulder, I turned around fast, hoping it was him, but it was always a fan and never my friend. When I woke up the next morning, I was relieved because at least I could see Baltimore out the window. But as my eyes focused, I realized there were iron bars in front of it, and I thought, you know, that isn't great. And it turned out I was in jail for doing crimes. I could see Mr. Dunn through the bars talking to a cop. His hands were clasped like he was praying. "Are you sure it was the babe?" he asked. "I'm afraid so," the cop said. "We have hundreds of witnesses all over town, and they all said the maniac was wearing an Orioles uniform." "But he's not wearing one," Mr. Dunn said. And the cop explained that I wasn't naked when they found me. That just kind of happened somehow during the madness of the chase. And Mr. Dunn put his head in his hands and groaned, and I've never heard anyone sound so tired. And I asked him if it was too late to make the game, and he reached through the bars and patted me on the shoulder and told me I wouldn't get to play games anymore. The league had a morality clause, and the commissioner was suspending me for the remainder of the season. And I asked if I could still hang around and maybe help the team practice or maybe be the ice boy, and he said he didn't think that was a good idea, and that it would probably be safest for me and everyone in Baltimore if I just went back to St. Mary's. And I started to cry because that was the thing I was most afraid he'd say. And then the door swung open, and it was Junior, and he was dressed to play, and he said they better go or else they'd miss the game. And Mr. Dunn said, "What happened? How did you lose him?" And Junior shrugged and said, "I tried my best, but he's incorrigible." and Mr. Dunn wandered off into the hallway, and Junior was about to go too, but I reached through the bars and grabbed his wrist because I realized it was my last chance to say goodbye. And I said I was sorry about last night. I didn't mean to get lost. And he said, "It's fine, babe." And he tried to get away, but I held on because I had some more to say. And I told him how happy I was that we had met and that if anyone deserved to make it to the big leagues, it was him. And that I would follow his career the best I could, even though we didn't get newspapers at the home, other than the scraps they put out for wiping in the shitter. And he swallowed and said, "Thanks, babe." And then I said, "There's one more thing." And I looked around the jail to make sure no one was listening. And I explained that I had one other secret to baseball that I hadn't told him last time. But now that my career was over and he was still playing, he could have it. And he leaned in close, and I told him the secret. And this is what the secret was. "You don't always want to hit everything with mustard." And then I smiled and leaned back like, "You're welcome." But I could tell he was confused, so I decided to give an example. When they give you a fastball, you always want to hit the thing with mustard. But when they give you a screwball, the way that spins, you'll never hit it over the fence, no matter how much mustard you give it. But if you lay off the mustard and shift your body, you can tap it to the other side, and that's the secret to baseball. Don't hit the ball where you think it ought to go. Hit it where it wants to go, to the place where it's already going. Hit it to the place where it belongs. And I wasn't sure if Junior liked the secret because he was silent for a while and kind of looking off into the distance. And I told him I was sorry if I hadn't been so great a friend. I always tried my best, but sometimes in life, you can try your best at something and still end up not being so great. And he looked at me and said, "Yeah, I know what you mean." And then the cop came back with Mr. Dunn, and they said it was time to write up my confession. And I said I was happy to, but they would have to help me because I didn't remember doing anything. And then Junior took a step forward, and he had a look in his eyes I'd never seen before. Kind of like a pitcher when he likes the catcher's sign. And he said, "That's because you didn't do anything." And he turned to the cop and said, "I did." And he said that the cops had the wrong guy, and that the Oriole uniform everyone saw belonged to him. And Mr. Dunn whispered to him, "Son, you don't have to do this." And Junior ignored him and took out a pen and said he was willing to sign any confession. And the cop shrugged and said, "All right, but we need to go through the counts one by one and put them all in the public record." And Junior said, "Go right ahead." "Public intoxication," said the cop. "That was me," Junior said. "Public nudity?" "Me." "Public urination?" Junior hesitated. And some newspaper people started taking photographs of his face. And Junior flinched because, you know, they were taking a whole lot of them. "Public urination?" the cop asked again. "Yes," Junior said softly. "That was me." "Shitting in a mailbox while shouting out special delivery?" "Yes," Junior said. "Me." And the cop added up all the fines and said Junior owed $65. And I figured Mr. Dunn would be angry with his son for being a degenerate alcoholic maniac. But instead, he gave him a hug, like he was proud. And he paid the fine and clapped his hands and said, "Let's get to the ballpark." The commissioner suspended Junior for the season, but even though he couldn't play, Mr. Dunn kept him with the team. And Junior started using his statistics book to help the rest of us, like figuring out when in the order we should bat, and which stadiums we should pull in, and when to shift the infield. And we started winning games by even more runs than before. And Junior got so busy that one time Deke shouted out, "Ice boy!" And Mr. Dunn said, "Not now." Because, you know, his son had bigger things to do. And we got back into first place. And one day, after beating the Bisons, three guys in suits walked up to the dugout. And they said that they were from the Red Sox and they wanted to have a chat with Mr. Dunn. And Junior turned to his dad and said, "Congratulations." And Mr. Dunn said, "I couldn't have done it without you, kiddo." And he turned to the Red Sox man and said he couldn't wait to bring his first-place spirit to the major leagues. And the Red Sox man said, "There's been a misunderstanding. We aren't here to hire you. We're here to sign Babe Ruth." And Mr. Dunn pleaded with them that he deserved a shot as manager because he had coached his team into first place. And they said they didn't doubt his coaching abilities, but in their view, the Orioles' success had less to do with coaching than with the fact that they had found what could only be described as a baseball monster. And Mr. Dunn started talking really fast, like a chicken auctioneer. And he said he didn't have to be the manager. He could be a pitching coach or a first base coach. And the Red Sox guys sighed and looked at each other and shrugged. And eventually one of them smiled tightly and said, "How about this? You give us Babe Ruth, and you can come up to Boston and be sort of like an honorary coach. You can sit in the dugout and wear a cap and the whole thing. And hey, your boy looks like a ball player. Maybe he can come up to Boston too, and we'll give him a tryout and uniform, and you can both say you're major leaguers." And Junior said, "Dad, I've got an idea." And he told me to wait with the Red Sox men while they talked in the next room. And when the Duns were gone, I turned to the three guys and asked them straight away if they had ever met Cy Young. And they said they had. And then I asked them if they had ever met Ty Cobb. And they said they had. And then I asked them if they'd ever met Walter Johnson. And they sighed and said, yes, they had met all the famous baseball players. So I asked them if they had ever met Home Run Baker. And we talked like that for a few more hours, and it was a really fun afternoon. When the Duns came back, Junior was holding his notebook, and I saw that he'd written down all sorts of new numbers. And Mr. Dunn nodded at his son and said, "Jack, take it away." And Jack told the Red Sox they could sign me, and they didn't have to let the Duns play or coach up in the majors. All they had to do was give them a whole bunch of money. And the Red Sox man sighed and said, "How much?" And Jack said, "Enough to build the best damn minor league program in the league." And he listed all the things they would need, like a new dugout and better uniforms and modern training equipment and a strength and conditioning coach. And altogether, it came to thousands of dollars. And then they all sat down and filled out papers for a while. And then I found out I was going to ride another train. And it was going to be first class this time, which meant all the food I wanted, even if it cost more than $3. And I asked the Duns if they could come up with me to Boston, at least for a little while. And they said they couldn't because they had a lot of work to do. They'd probably lose this season now that I was leaving, but next season was right around the corner. And I told Jack I would miss rooming with him and that I hoped he made it up to the Red Sox like me, and he said he didn't want to do that anymore. He'd heard my advice loud and clear. And I said, "What do you mean?" And he smiled and said, "Life threw me a screwball, and I'm not going to try to force it over the fence. I'm going to tap the ball where it belongs." And I said I had no idea what he was talking about because my advice was about baseball and he wasn't playing baseball anymore. And he said, "Exactly." And I said, "Are we still talking about baseball? I have no idea what's going on. I'm completely lost." And he looked me in the eye and said that the main thing is that I had done a great job on the team. And he was happy we were friends. And I gave him a bear hug and went off to start my life. And now it's 5 years later and everything is different. I only play in big stadiums, and when I leave the field, all the crowds come and follow me around. And it's a pretty swell life. Like, for example, sometimes they'll throw me a parade or put me in a picture show, or a young woman will see me on the street and tell me to screw her right there where I'm standing, even though she's with her husband. And I'll be like, "What about him?" And the husband will be like, "Do it. This is the closest I will get to glory." But no matter how much fun I'm having, I never forget about my friends, the Duns. And whenever I think of it, I write them a letter, care of the Baltimore Orioles. And last month, they wrote me back and sent me a picture of them holding up a championship AA trophy. And on the plaque, it said both of their names. Manager, Jack Dunn Sr., and co-manager, Jack Dunn Jr. And they said that they missed me in the lineup, but it seems like they're doing all right. It seems like they figured it out. It seems like they found a way to win.
This has been an Audible Originals production of Screwball, written by Simon Rich, performed by Beck Bennett and Scott Aiello. Executive producers David Blum, Laura Gatchko, and Mike Charzik. Editorial producer Andrew Eisenman. Produced and directed by Chris Sacco. Sound design by Tim Kim. Mixed and mastered by Tim Kim. Copyright 2019 by Simon Rich. Sound recording copyright 2019 by Audible Originals, LLC.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.